And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Ussery, and I'm happy to welcome Joe Watson Hackle to the program today. Joe is an attorney in South Carolina, but today we'll be talking about her debut novel for younger readers, which is set in her native state of Mississippi. While not autobiographical in terms of plot, Joe's love of the Mississippi countryside is one of the major aspects of Smack Dab in the Middle of Maybe, which is published by Random House Books for young readers. The narrator of Smack Dab in the Middle of Maybe is a girl named Cricket Overland, and she has a plan as the book opens up, but she's worried about her willpower, isn't she?
She is indeed. She has been wanting to go off and to try and get her mother back, and she knows that it's going to be a hard journey. She'll be leaving the safety of her Aunt Belinda's house and really having to sit out in uncharted territories. She's never been in the woods that she's going to without her father there, and she's really unsure if she can make the trip.
Now, there's a lot we as the reader don't know as the book opens up.
That's true.
You give that information very sparingly as the story goes along. Was that, in a sense, to kind of like give an idea of the trouble that Cricket was having trouble with that information and kind of like actually integrating into herself, or was it just for pure drama's sake?
Cricket is a girl who's still coming to terms with some of the decisions that she's made and with her own family dynamics. And so she is telling a story, and like many storytellers, she shares information with the readers when she has kind of come to terms with it herself, or at least feels like she's come to a place where she can talk about it. And so I really tried to make it a conversational, natural voice that Cricket has talking directly to a reader. And just as if you were meeting someone for the first time, you wouldn't tell them your deepest, darkest secrets that you were kind of scared of yourself. So Cricket slowly gets comfortable telling her story and also gets more comfortable with her own backstory and does share it as she spends time in the world, in the woods, and gains a new perspective.
Now, did Cricket come to you first, or the plot of the story?
Really, Cricket came to me first. I actually grew up in a ghost town modeled on the real-life ghost town of Electric Mills, Mississippi, and loved exploring the woods growing up. They poured the sidewalks of the original town very, very thickly, so I had the great experience of being able to walk on thick, straight sidewalks through overgrown bushes, briars, and woods, and really wanted to create a character who lived in that world and was from that area and had a little bit of that sense of curiosity and maybe even a little bit of determination that I had at Cricket's age.
Now, for us people who are able to use Google Maps, we know that Electric Mills, Mississippi, was between Meridian, Mississippi, which is in the eastern part of the state, and Starkville, where Mississippi State University, most people know where
That's
that
right.
is, and the W at Columbus.
That's right.
But where is Electric City supposed to be in the state?
Electric City is set slightly south of Meridian in its fictional iteration, and the reason for that is because along Cricket's journey, she takes a field cricket named Charlene, and Charlene chirps throughout the story, and crickets only chirp at certain temperatures. And so I worked with entomologists at Mississippi State University to make sure that the information was accurate, and we decided to set it a little bit further south so we would have more warm days when a cricket would actually be active and chirping.
And she finds that cricket in Thelma's Cash and Carry. Why are she and Aunt Belinda and her cousins at the Cash and Carry?
Well, it is the day of the fish fry the town celebrates every year. And Aunt Belinda is trying to impress a new volunteer fireman that she has her sights set on. And she's setting out to make homemade potato salad and red velvet cake and has set Cricket off in search of some of the things that she needs for those recipes.
I loved a lot of the little touches in the book, and especially in that grocery store scene there at the beginning. Aunt Belinda answering the phone because she wants to win a radio contest.
That's right.
And the devotion to Duke's mayonnaise.
Yes, indeed. I tried to put as many references to Southern products and the things that I grew up with as possible, and also to incorporate all of the senses in every scene. And, you know, when you think of Duke's mayonnaise, that recalls, you know, a very specific taste. And so I wanted for readers to really feel when they were reading the book that they were stepping inside Cricket's world. And so those tiny little details were some of the things that I tried to incorporate in to give them that perspective.
Of course, Red Velvet has become a nationwide phenomenon over like the last 10, 15 years. But it was my birthday cake when I was a little boy in the early 70s.
That's great.
And then I wasn't allowed to have it for a lot of years because of the red dye number 3 scare.
Right, right. I'm happy to say my family still eat red velvet cake despite the red dye scare. You know, there are so many rich Southern traditions of people cooking cakes for various events. And I thought the red velvet cake is just an iconic Southern cake. So I had to find a way to slip that in as well.
Is it G-A-G or gag?
She calls her gag. It's spelled G-A-G, but it's gag. Great Aunt Genevieve. And Great Aunt Genevieve is a relative. Cricket's father has died, and Cricket has been taken in by her Aunt Belinda. Because Cricket is underage, she's receiving some Social Security checks, and Great Aunt Genevieve is very interested in taking in Cricket and those Social Security checks. And Cricket does not like Great Aunt Genevieve at all, and so gave her the nickname G-A-G, or gag.
And one of the worst aspects is that she lives up in Kentucky.
Yes.
And Cricket wants to be in town on March 1st.
That's right. When her mother left, she left a note for Cricket that she was going to be in the family graveyard on March 1st. And Cricket knew that she was going to keep that promise because she wrote, "No matter what." And Cricket's mother has sometimes not been able to do things that she wanted to do, but she has never, ever broken a no matter what promise. So Cricket is bound and determined to find a way to get her mother to come back and to stay home for good. And so is determined to be at that cemetery on March 1st.
And since she overhears a conversation thinking that this coming Wednesday she's going to have to go up to Kentucky, as they say in the criminal set, she goes to ground.
She went to ground, indeed. And she had a little bit of inspiration from the cricket that she found in that grocery store.
And what did she end up naming the cricket?
Charlene. Well, Charlene is her mother's middle name. It's actually the name of one of my favorite aunts as well. So I thought that that was a perfect name for a cricket.
So have any of your aunts read the book yet?
They have. And, you know, family will always tell you they love the book. I hope they really, really love the book because...
Because aunts don't have a real good reputation in this book.
Well, that particular aunt doesn't. But I have to say I'm blessed with wonderful, wonderful aunts and uncles and cousins. And my family has been extraordinarily supportive of this whole writing process.
Now, she and Charlene the Cricket strike up a kind of a contentious friendship early on in the bathroom.
That's right.
That leads to something unexpected happening at the store.
Indeed. And actually, I've got to tell you that the scene with finding the cricket is inspired by something our daughter did when she was 4. We were in the grocery store, in the deepest parts of the grocery store, and she found a cricket. And we were too far away and too into our shopping to go run out. And so she kept the cricket in her cupped hand through the entire shopping experience and let the cricket out when we got outside and could find a safe grassy area for the cricket. And at the time, I, as I still do today, was keeping a writing journal, and I thought, what a great detail. And I've been locked inside a library twice in my life, and so thought, well, wouldn't it be interesting if while a character was trying to save a cricket, she accidentally got left behind. And in this case, it was in Thelma's Cash and Carry. Because when Cricket went to try and let Charlene the Cricket out the window, Charlene went wild, as crickets sometimes do, jumped all over all the stalls in the bathroom. And by the time Cricket had finally caught her, she discovered that she has been left behind in Thelma's Cash and Carry.
Which is actually a great time to make her escape.
Indeed. Cricket had been thinking of going off to live in this treehouse. Now she has a deadline. She knows she's about to get sent off. And she is in a grocery store with all kinds of provisions, and she has some cash in her pocket. So she does some quick grocery shopping and decides to set off for this ghost town that is right next to the cemetery where her mother's going to be on March 1st.
Now, how did you come up with the specific list of items that she was going to abscond with?
I really did it a combination of things that you would need for outdoor survival and also tried to channel my 12-year-old self. Yeah, the book is entirely fiction. It's not autobiographical, but I did draw on the things that as a 12-year-old I enjoyed, and one of those was Little Debbie Snack Cakes.
Well, there's all sorts of varieties, so which ones in particular was she getting?
The little round cakes, and it was something that with her three cousins she didn't get a chance to eat very often because they would try and gobble them up. And so when she found herself in the grocery store with nobody around to take anything away from her, she just could not resist getting her hands on those Little Debbie snack cakes. And so she took them off to the woods with her with a number of other very practical things.
In the book, cell phones exist.
They do.
So we know it's probably within the last 20 years or so of this action. Beyond that detail, it could have been set just at about any time in the past 60, 70 years.
Right. That's a great question. Actually, it's set in current time. But I really wanted to create a book that wasn't, say, specifically a 2018 book or a 2017 book, but hopefully one that readers could come back to after a few years and it would still feel as fresh and speak to them in perhaps a different way as they get older. When I have gone back and read books that I read as a child, if there are too many technology details that are tied specifically to that time, it does sort of take you a bit out of that action. And I really wanted to create a timeless story.
Our childhoods are very much different from contemporary childhoods with the amount of electronic devices that we're using.
Certainly.
So at what point does it start to seem quaint that she's not engaging with technology?
Since she's been taken in by Aunt Belinda, she doesn't have a cell phone because Aunt Belinda's too cheap to pay for her to have a cell phone. And, you know, a lot of children are in that situation, particularly in the rural South. So I don't know that I would call it quaint. It's just, it's Cricket's reality. Aunt Belinda has a cell phone, but Cricket does not. She very much wishes she did, particularly when she's out in the woods. But if she had had a cell phone, she would have no way to charge it. So it would have quickly become useless.
But she is able to exist out in the woods when she goes out for what her father called woods time.
Indeed.
Because of the training and a journal her father had left for her.
That's right. Yes. Her father had a book that had all sorts of advice for living in the woods. And his dream had been to share those experiences with her and that knowledge with her as she grew older. And he had already shared a number of things. They had spent a lot of time out in the treehouse in the woods. And it was his hope that in a few years to take her on a woods time experience. And unfortunately, he didn't live long enough to be able to do that. So part of the struggle that Cricket has is having to do a woods time that she's somewhat unprepared for, but still has to do on her own. So she draws a lot on the memories of her father and the things that she's learned from him and also things that she just kind of has to learn the hard way on her own.
Because woods time seems a little bit like, as they say, walkabout down in Australia.
It is. I think just about every culture has some tradition of going off into the wild. And I love the way that the father observes that with woods time, you better get comfortable with whoever it is you are. And there is that sense of being by yourself in the woods, connecting with nature that lends a new perspective to whatever it is that you're dealing with. And I found personally that spending time in the woods is so centering and calming and a great way to relax and, for lack of a better word, just experience some of God's creation. And it gives you time to think about whatever is on your mind.
And so is there a real life inspiration for woods time?
Well, growing up, I spent as much time outdoors exploring the woods as possible. And in our own family, for over 20 years, we've had a great tradition that has been a real source of kind of relaxation and family bonding for us. And that's on Sundays. We unplug completely from electronics, don't do any work, weather permitting, spend as much time outdoors as possible. We build campfires when we can, have dinner over the campfires, just kind of meander in the garden. Often we'll eat things from the garden or things that we find to forage from the woods. And, you know, just kind of pay attention to the birds and the squirrels and even sometimes coyotes out in the woods. And it is amazing how much better the week feels on Monday, having had that unplugged day on Sunday. And I hope some people will consider incorporating a little bit of woods time into their own weekly routine.
Now, you grew up on the Gulf in Mississippi. Do you live near the ocean in South Carolina?
Well, actually, when I was 11, we moved to the real-life ghost town of Electric Mills, Mississippi. So I had the great pleasure of having both the Gulf and then the Mississippi Midland Country, Timber Country, and a little bit of that experience. And I think coming to a ghost town from somewhere else was a terrific experience because it let me see the ghost town with outside eyes that had I been born and raised completely there, I don't think I would have thought that it was so unique or special or picked up on so many of those details.
Being on your own is one thing, but being a 12-year-old who recently goes from having two parents to no parents, mm-hmm. it seems like the effect on one's sense of self would be so dramatic, the change in that short period of time that suddenly, you know, she's the only child of a couple, and now she's all alone.
Right. It is dramatic. And as we meet Cricket, you know, I don't want to give the impression this is just a totally serious book. Cricket has a great sense of humor and spunk and determination, and you see that right from the beginning in her voice. But you can also tell that she's dealing with some real challenges in her life, and she has not yet come to terms with that. And that's why I think woods time for her is particularly important, because it allows her to find strength that she didn't even know existed inside herself. And my hope is that readers who are maybe going through whatever challenges they are in their life will also discover that they're stronger than they think and will get a little bit of inspiration from Cricket's journey and hopefully have some fun with her along the way as she tries to solve the clue trail.
But she did also have a little bit of experience missing her father because I guess he worked on an oil platform mm-hmm. down in the Gulf.
Right.
And so he'd be gone for weeks and weeks at a time.
That's right. So Cricket and her mother had spent quite a good long stretches of time, just the two of them. And so, you know, that gave her an experience with just one parent alone. But the loss of a parent anytime is a huge shock and blow and takes a lot of time to try and begin healing from.
And we also do learn that her time with her parents before wasn't exactly the easiest time.
That's right.
Even though it was probably the time that she wants more than anything else again.
Right. Cricket's mother suffers from mental health issues. And as the book goes on, Cricket becomes more and more open and sort of comes to terms herself with that issue, even while loving her mother as much as any child can love their mother, but also realizing that, like all people, her mother had her challenges and her strengths. And I think Cricket's journey is understanding that she can hold conflicting emotions about her mother in her head at the same time and still love her mother with her whole heart, as she should.
And she's 12, so she's probably getting ready to go through puberty.
Right.
And that amplifies every emotion by 10, it seems.
That's right. And I really did try and give Cricket a voice that was very authentic to that, you know, where she is in her life. And so when Cricket feels an emotion, she feels it pretty strongly and isn't afraid to tell the reader what's on her mind.
So she beats a trail to Electric City.
She does.
And fortunately, she and her father had built a treehouse.
Yes. So they were great lovers of nature. And so they originally built this treehouse on old family land to do some bird watching and take photographs of the deer and squirrels and other animals in the forest. And so they had camped out, but they hadn't camped out for 11 days.
At one point, she makes green onion pancakes.
Yes.
How does one make green onion pancakes without a lot of provisions?
I will say it's not the prettiest green onion pancake that you've ever seen in your life, but she uses some materials that she found in the woods and combines that with some grasses and peanut butter, of course, to fry it up, and kind of does a makeshift recipe based on something that her mother had made. And she uses hickory nuts instead of pecans in the pancake.
And she also learns that raccoons aren't real big observers of state laws about ownership.
That's right. Raccoons pretty much follow the rule of if I could see it, it's mine. And raccoons are wonderful, fascinating animals. But they also will take advantage of any food source they can find. And in this story, a food source is all the provisions that Cricket has brought with her.
And even her father's journal.
And even her father's journal, because it had been around the hickory smoke fire. and had absorbed some of those food smells. So the raccoons not only took away her matches and most of her food, but also pretty much destroyed her father's journal.
Now, Charlene the cricket is with her, and do you think she could have survived this period of time without having Charlene's company?
I don't know if it's a question of survival, but I do know that Charlene played a really important role in the story for Cricket, in that it gave her a sounding board and someone to talk to and to run ideas past and to express emotion to in a way that certainly at the beginning of the story, she didn't feel comfortable really saying out loud to herself. But over time, she becomes more comfortable saying things to Charlene.
Now, you made an allusion to it a little bit earlier, and she's just not out in the woods passing time. She's trying to solve a mystery,
mm-hmm.
a mystery from her mother's childhood.
That's right.
So what is the bird room? What is the story her mother has told her about the bird room?
Well, the bird room is a magical-seeming painted room. It's painted walls, ceiling, and floor to reflect the natural area of Electric City. And her mother saw it as a child, and the bird room had windows whose light came in and really seemed to make the paintings come alive. And when she was a small child, she thought the paintings actually were alive, and no one believed her. The room has had such an effect on her, and she actually had met the artist who painted the room, and he told her that he was going to leave her a clue trail to a treasure. So Cricket's mom had been obsessed her entire life with finding the bird room and proving that it actually existed.
Finding a bird room in an abandoned town that has no more buildings left seems to be quite a challenge.
It is quite the challenge. Fortunately, Cricket, after her mother left, found a Dougaloo. And a Dougaloo is the script that was used in the old lumber town. And when the paint flaked off the Dougaloo, she realized that it was tied to the town. So she knew that something in the town was tied to the bird room. So she doesn't know if she will find the actual bird room, but she hopes that she will find something that she can show to her mother to prove that it really exists.
A lot of readers may not be familiar with company towns anymore.
Right.
So can you tell us about what Electric Mills was like and why they had their own money? And the Dougaloos.
Electric Mills is such a fascinating town, and I'm delighted to get to tell it, a little bit of its story with readers. It was founded in 1913, and when you think about rural Mississippi at that time, you can imagine how unusual it was to have electric power. Electric Mills was one of the first electric lumber mills in the country, and the entire town, including houses, all had electricity, and they would, I understand, I've heard stories about, would even have Christmas lights during the holidays. And it at one time was called the brightest town south of St. Louis. It had a 300-seat theater, teaching hospital, a library with over 3,000 volumes of books, and it was a booming town as they were harvesting virgin timber. But when all the timber was harvested, they took the buildings up. Many of them were sold off. A few remained, but went off in search of other towns with abundant timber ready to be harvested.
So why did they have their own money, like as you said, a scrip?
It was a way to keep, as I understand it, a very convenient way to encourage trade with the company commissary and for people within the town to trade with one another. And it very much was a company town. Everyone who lived in the town worked at the company. Many of their spouses did. They had a great central park and a playground. And so the entire life of the community was centered around that employer. And so I would imagine to the owners, it seemed natural to also have a currency that worked for that town as well. And I've got to tell you, I just love the name Dougaloo. I thought I had to find a way to work it into the story.
And that was quite common with coal mining towns
as well. Right. That's right.
From the song 16 Tons,
yes.
I Owe My Soul to the Company Store.
Indeed, indeed. And, you know, with the Dougaloo, people were spending their money with the company store.
So that's a way for them to really cut labor costs down because they're making a profit off the everyday phases of life as well.
Right, right. But I will say from the stories that I've heard, and I've interviewed a number of people who lived in Electric Mills, the overwhelming sense was of happiness and a sense of being valued. I never heard a single complaint about being paid in Dougaloo or a sense that the company wasn't taking care of its employees. They really did feel valued, from what they've told me, with a sense of not only purpose, but also a great sense of community. The town regularly had barbecues and celebrations for holidays and ice cream and things that brought the community together in a way that sometimes we don't see today.
Now, there is a type of bird that is key to the story, and that's a scarlet tanager. What is a tanager like?
A tanager is, in many ways, a magical sounding bird. It's certainly a beautiful bird. It has a red body that turns to green in the fall when it flies to South America to migrate. It's typically found in the very tallest treetops. So I thought that was a great symbol to use in the story for a sense of kind of being out of reach or very elusive and hard to find. And so I put the scarlet tanager in the bird room and made that something that had really resonated with Cricket's mother.
Have you seen them out in the wild?
I wish I had seen them out in the wild. They are a very hard bird to find in the wild. I know people who have, but sadly I have not. But I am still looking, and I hope one day to find a scarlet tanager.
Were you a bird watcher before you began the book?
I was, and I still am.
As we talk about this hunt for the treasure that these clues were left behind, what is worthy number three?
That is the first clue that Cricket finds out in the woods that's carved onto a tree. There's a scarlet tanager bird that she finds, and in very tiny letters is written worthy number three. When she sees that, she knows that an artist, most likely the artist who's created the bird room, has been in that area. And so that's the clue that really sets her heart to thumping, because she knows that she's onto something.
Now, in the end matter of the book, you talk that there was a very real artist that inspired the idea of the bird paintings.
Indeed. My very favorite artist is Walter Inglis Anderson. I'm a huge admirer of his work. The room is fictionalized. The artist character is completely fiction, but it was inspired by his glorious little room that he left when he died. He lived and worked in Ocean Springs, Mississippi, and at his death, they discovered a secret room that he hadn't told anyone about. And the floor, walls, and ceiling were painted to reflect a day on the Mississippi Gulf Coast. And he used the light outside the windows to shine on the scenes in the room that would correspond to what would be most active in the Mississippi Gulf Coast at that time of day. So as the sun shines in from the east, you see the morning scenes and the rooster crowing, and then it follows around until you start seeing bats coming out at night and a cat at night. And so you start to experience the things that would be visible on the Mississippi Gulf Coast at night. And so it really is an immersive experience. And I would urge anyone who hasn't yet visited the Walter Anderson Museum of Art to go pay it a visit.
Is that down in Ocean Springs?
It is in Ocean Springs, yes. And as part of the book, we put together a map of Cricket's world. We call it a smack dab trail, and highlighted some of the things that were important in the book and that provided inspiration in the book, or that Cricket and her mother visited in the fiction in the book. And one of those cities is, of course, Ocean Springs, Mississippi. And I hope that lots of readers will go and check it out.
Now, up in the Memphis area, we, of course, know the Delta region of Mississippi and the Hill Country near Oxford. But the Gulf Coast and then kind of the Plains area down south are very distinct. What do you think kind of ties all these together as a state of Mississippi, with these regions being so different from each other?
They are very different regions, but in my experience, the thing that unites all Mississippians is our deep love of storytelling and our deep connection to the land. And no matter where you grow up, there is this sense that the land is almost a part of you. So I tried to create for readers that sense of place, the thought, hopefully the experience of being out there in the woods, seeing what Cricket would see, smelling what she'd smell, feeling what she'd feel, tasting what she'd taste, and hearing what she'd hear, so that they feel as though they're right out there with her And even if they're not from Mississippi or even from the South, can kind of get a little bit of sense of that connection.
And it seems that the state of Mississippi has produced more riders per capita than any other state in the Union.
I think that's certainly true. When you look at all the brilliant riders who are from Mississippi, it is an incredible list.
Now, there are a lot more adventures and trials and adversities Cricket has to face, but we're going to leave that for the reader.
Oh, good.
To discover those. But we'd like to know, are you working on another project right now?
I am working on another project right now. Everything I write has two elements. One is outdoor adventure, survival element, and the other part is a clue trail. One of the many great things about being a writer is that you can find things that interest you, that you think might be interesting to readers. And if you can figure out a way to make them work in a clue trail, you can put them in a book. I spent a lot of time researching things that I just thought were interesting and fascinating and that I wanted to share a little bit about with the reader and find a way to have one clue lead to another, lead to another, lead to another, and really to create an experience where the reader is solving the clue trail along with Cricket. So I tried to put in just enough information that a really smart reader will get that aha moment at about the same time that Cricket reaches that aha moment. And I'll look forward to hearing from readers and seeing if I've succeeded in striking that balance.
Now, when you're creating the clue trail, do you start with the finish line and work your way back, or?
I'll tell you, I started with a few elements built on it, and it probably took me over 20 tries working with my editor and a lot of drafts to come up with a clue trail that included the elements that we wanted to include, made sense for the reader. And we were also limited, if you think about it, because in the book, the clue trail is 30 years old. So they all had to be elements that would survive out in the woods for 30 years that Cricket could still find and could still read to the extent that there's writing, and things that she would have the materials in the woods to be able to decipher on her own. So that ruled out a lot of other things that I thought would be very interesting, but I couldn't include in the trail. But I hope readers will find that I included some things that will interest them as well.
There's been very generous reviews of the book in the trade magazines. You have great blurbs on the back cover. So we know what grown-ups think about the book. But what are the younger readers you've heard from saying about the book?
I'll tell you, one of the best parts of the whole writing experience is finally getting to meet readers. The book just came out. So this is my first stretch of my book tour. And being able to meet children who have read the book is just the biggest thrill of my life. So far, they have been extraordinarily kind and have asked great, insightful questions about nearly every element of the book. So it's been a wonderful way to see the book through their eyes. And as a writer, you put a lot of details in that you hope people will notice and see a little bit of symbolism in or have things that spark their curiosity. And I will tell you, young readers are smart, and they have picked up on every single one of the things that I hoped that they would, and they have asked great questions about it.
What's the most surprising thing do you think they've picked up on so far?
That's a tough one, because they asked some great questions. I've gotten some questions about the meaning of the choice of having Cricket's companion be a field cricket. And so we've talked a lot about, you know, crickets being a symbol of luck and of changing luck and how that resonates with the story. I've also gotten great questions about why I said it in the winter coming to spring, the way that the weather is changing and warming and the spring flowers are starting to come out, the tree leaves are starting to turn green, and how the natural world is changing and the way that that sort of parallels some of the changes that Cricket is experiencing herself. So that's been a lot of fun to discuss with young readers. And I've also really had a great time talking to not only young readers, but also young writers who want to talk about how they've used the book to inspire some of their own writing projects. And so we've kind of brainstormed together a bit on that. So that's been fun.
Young readers almost always want to know, what books did you love when you were a child?
They do. They do. And actually, two of my favorite books helped to inspire this book. And those books are My Side of the Mountain, which takes readers on an outdoor survival adventure and makes surviving outdoors a quest of its own. And then From the Mixed Up Files of Mrs. Basil E. Frankweiler. And I love how from the Mixed Up Files of Mrs. Basile, Frank Wilder really turns the Metropolitan Museum of Art almost into a character itself in the book and introduces the readers to a clue trail. And so I'm an enormous admirer of both of those books as well as many, many other books. And so I wanted to see if I could challenge myself to combine those two elements of outdoor survival and an art clue trail, and also to create the ghost town acting almost as a character itself in the novel. And I'll be interested to hear from readers if they think I've struck the right balance.
Well, Joe, I want to thank you so much for coming by today and sharing your book with us. It's been quite a pleasure.
Thank you. The pleasure's been mine. I appreciate you having me.
Joe Watson-Hackle is the author of Smack Dab in the Middle of Maybe, which is published by Random House Books for Young Readers. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.